This is Dan Austin at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Tony and Clara Cuccinello in Tampa, Florida. The date, Wednesday, June 12, 1991. This is an interview with them about Tony's, or Chick, or Push-Em-Up, whichever nickname we want to have. This interview is for the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And Tony, Clara, thank you very much for inviting me into your home for this interview. And Tony, I want to begin with where you were born, what year, and maybe a few recollections of your
youth. Dan, I wish you wouldn't bring in that year up.
Well, okay.
If it goes way back.
I'll say it's 1907.
Oh, yes, it is.
Okay.
I know you knew that, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Tony, where were you born?
I was born in Long Island City. Well, where? I mean, it was called Astoria at that time. Astoria, across the river from the East River from Manhattan.
In the Queens?
In Queens, yes.
Okay.
And well, you know all about Queens, too, don't you?
No, I'm just a Kansas kid. So the only thing I know in the Queens is Flushing.
November 8th, 1907.
Okay, coming up on your 84th birthday then.
Yeah. November will be
84. And so as a kid growing up in New York City, I guess you had your favorite ball club then.
I used to go up to the Polo Grounds and sit in the bleachers. And the Yankees, of course, didn't have their ballpark at that time. You know, I think it was built in 1923, somewhere around there.
Okay, they were known as the Highlanders then.
Yes, they played at the Polo Grounds, you know, too. Mm-hmm. When the Giants were away, they took over.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it a lot easier for Babe Ruth to hit home runs over there because the right field foul line was only about 258 feet.
No, was that in the Polo Grounds?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know they had that.
Oh, yeah, right field and left field, 259, and left field was about 260. Uh-huh. But then it went out real deep out into center field.
Yeah, that's right.
It went out to about 500 feet out where the clubhouses used to be, underneath the stands out there. Yeah.
I heard that even in the outer reaches of the outfield in the old Polo Grounds that it went downhill a little bit,
yes.
So that the manager, back along the third or first base side, couldn't see the outfielder's feet.
Yeah, but they fixed that up later on. They brought that down, either brought that down or brought the where the dugouts were, brought that
brought
up.
Or
you
could
see, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Don't you remember where Willie Mays made that catch with the big Wurtz?
That's right, 54 World Series.
54 World Series, my God. That was the ball game for us, too.
Yeah.
And we lost four straight.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you had that powerhouse of all those pitchers.
Yeah, four 320 game winners and 119 game winners.
That's right.
And we had Mossy and Narleski as relievers.
Yeah.
And those two kids, they pitched like hell. My God, really, really good.
Well, we jumped up from 1914 to 1954. Let's go back to as a kid, Coogan's Bluff.
Yeah, that's right. See, as I say, I used to go up to the Polo Grounds.
Did you take the subway?
I couldn't drive. I was only about 12 or 13 at the time.
So a bunch of you kids in the neighborhood would just get in the
subway? Well, yeah, but maybe two or three kids that were interested in baseball that played with me at the time. In fact, I thought they would make the big leagues quicker than I would, see?
Mm-hmm.
But no, we used to go up and occasionally we'd go see the Yankees, too, played at the Polo Grounds at that time. Babe Ruth was a great fan of mine. I mean, to me, he was the greatest thing in baseball. But I couldn't get to see them very often. I'd have to skip school to go see them play, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when Babe Ruth came to the Yankees, that was, what, about 1920?
About 20 or 21, somewhere around
there. Because the stadium was built about
23, the stadium.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough that
he... So you saw him play at the Polo Grounds then?
Polo Grounds before to the stadium, yes. And then I saw him play at the stadium about two or three days after the thing was built. And in fact, Babe Ruth at the new stadium at the time, he hit the first home run in the new stadium, and that's a thing like that. Of all the guys that hit home runs, the Babe had hit the first
one. Right.
You know,
And the house that Ruth built.
My God, wonderful.
Yeah.
And he was an idol. He was really an idol. I enjoyed his company very well. Got to know him. Got to meet him very good.
Oh,
you didn't see his picture inside. Autographed to me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's grand.
Later on, we used to play golf together.
Mm-hmm.
When he used to play at Westchester Country Club in Westchester, just north of the city of New York. But then it was his legs were bad, mm-hmm. and he couldn't walk around because we didn't have no carts at that time, golf carts. Mm-hmm. So then he came out to Long Island where everything was flat out there. Mm-hmm. We used to play at Bayside. And he'd follow us or we'd follow him. And
did you bet him on some holes there? Yeah. Or, I guess you took a little money off of him.
No. He hit the ball pretty good. He played real good golf. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At that time, I was just starting out, and I could play maybe 84, 85, 86. Mm-hmm. And he was in the late 70s and all like that.
So when you watch the, who are some of the giants that were your kind of heroes as kids going up
to the
Terry program?
Terry had just come up there.
Terry?
And we had a fellow from Long Island that was one of the pitchers on the ball club, Huey McQuillan. A good-looking man, and I think he married one of the showgirls. Mm-hmm. The show was Sweet Adeline at the time, because I got to meet her, too, later on. Mm-hmm. And he used to get me passes to go out and watch him play.
Well, how'd you, as a kid, meet the ball players? What, did you just go stay around the locker room after the game?
No, I never did. No. Uh-huh. I talked to him, like the days that he would pitch, he'd invite me up there.
Really? So before as a kid, did you become acquainted with him?
Well, we lived in Long Island, maybe about two or three blocks from where I lived.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. His brother owned a limousine service, mm-hmm. and he and a boy by the name of Delaney, they run both the service, and they brought Huey in with them for a while, mm-hmm. but then Huey, he liked baseball so much, and that was his life, mm-hmm. and he was pitching. I got to meet him there, then he said, if you want to see some games, let me know. And I'll get, sure enough, I want to see every, but I had to skip school to go see him. That's the big problem.
And how'd you arrange that? How'd you arrange skipping school? Your parents would find out, I gather.
Well, no, I just didn't say anything.
You just kept
quiet. Went up to the ball game, come back home, then like I went to school. I didn't say a word about it. I didn't bring up the ball game, but they would know then.
That's right. Yeah. So you had to keep quiet all the secrets of the day. Yeah. Of course, that was all daytime baseball at that time.
And it was a funny thing that after Huey quit playing ball, there was a little place in, it was sort of a tavern. A fellow used to go there, and the fellow served beer at that time, but didn't pay for it. It was more of a gift. Hmm. And Huey used to come there for his beer, and I used to sit down and talk baseball with him.
Oh, really?
That's how I got to know more about the New York Giant Ball Club than I did the Yankees at that time.
Well, of course, the Giants were a powerhouse in
Day one pennants, I think 21, 22, 23, mm-hmm. right there. And that's just, I was in school at that time, in grade school.
And of course, that was the beginning of that great rivalry between the Giants and the Yankees.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I think they played in two or three World Series right about that time.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Remember, Casey Stengel hit two home runs in one of the games.
Mm-hmm. For the Giants.
Yes. I got to see one of the games in the bleachers, of course. See, at that time, the bleachers were only 50 cents.
Even for the World Series?
Yes, it's for the World Series, yeah. Well, I mean, at that time, even your grandstand seats were only $1.10.
Well, that's true.
And the box seats, I believe, about $2.20. Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't like today. Today, I guess, if you brought your family to, you'd need $100.
You better take a $100 bill. You better take a C-note.
To a family of four, at least, yeah.
Take a family. Yeah. At the time, you have popcorn and hot dog and a beer or something and parking. So that's where your first brush then, actually meeting and getting acquainted with some of these major league players.
Yeah, and I started playing semi-pro ball right in Long Island at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was an old-time ball player that lived in Long Island at the time, and I think he was barred from baseball, Heinie Zimmerman. He run Eddie Collins across home plate, and he couldn't catch Eddie because Eddie could run real good, you know. Mm-hmm. And they claim that he should have thrown the ball, but he says there was nobody at home plate to catch the ball, and so we had to try to catch him, and he didn't do it, and it was a ball game. And it was just Judge Landis barred him from baseball.
For pulling that trick.
Yeah, for pulling. He thought maybe there was some difficulty there about the thing, mm-hmm. see? And he was my manager in semi-pro.
Oh, I see.
I got $7 a ball game, and I was in grade school at the time.
You were in grade school playing semi-pro ball?
Yes, sirree.
How'd they pick you out playing
Well, I had played with a smaller semi-pro outfit, and they had
still in grade school?
Yes. I was in PS 85
in Queens. You must have had good lateral movement on the infield to pick up, snag those balls then.
And he was my manager at the time. I played third base. Of course, he was a third baseman also. And we played a lot of the colored clubs, the black boys there. Yeah. And he used to move me back and forth, right or left, and like that. And he said, you look in, I'd look in. He'd say, to the right, to the left, go back, come in, that he knew these fellows that we were playing against all the time. And I played there for 2 or 3 years before I finally had a tryout with the Syracuse club.
So this was in the, early 20s?
It was about 24, 25, no, it was 26 then. I had played 2 or 3 years.
So you got $7 a game. Where'd you get your uniform?
Well, they had uniforms.
The company that sponsored your team. Yeah.
We had a dress in an old...
woolly, baggy ones, didn't you?
Yes, woolen ones and hot as could be. Yeah.
You'd sweat through them by the end of the first inning.
Oh, gee, especially if it was a hot day, you'd perspire terrifically there.
I heard a story that a lot of the ball players, a lot of the managers, didn't want their ball players to drink any water. It was bad for them to have water in their stomach and all that. Did you grow up with that kind of
thing? But they used to put something in the water that wouldn't affect your stomach or anything like that. I don't know what, and it wasn't chlorine. I don't think it was chlorine.
Salt tablet?
Something like that, like salt tablets that you put in there that wouldn't make you sick or hurt your stomach in any way at all on account of the heat, you know.
But so you played semi-pro, and I guess...
I was in school 23. Until now, I played semi-pro until 26, until about around May or June. I finally went over to Jersey City. I was invited over to Jersey City to work out with the Syracuse club of the International League. So I was there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and they said, we'd like very much for you to come to Newark. We're going to Newark tomorrow to play 3 more games there before taking off on a road trip. I said, yes, I'll come over. So the second day I was in Newark, they handed me a contract to sign with the Syracuse club.
And how much was that contract?
The contract was $350 a month.
Yeah, that's good money.
Well, gee, to me, that was $350. I couldn't believe it. You know, after playing, getting paid $7 a ball game, $350. And I couldn't sign the contract because I wasn't of age.
That's right.
At the time, I had to take home my... My dad had to sign the contract for me.
Were your mom and dad supportive of your going into baseball?
Well, my father wasn't. No, he wanted me to
go to school and learn.
Go to school and get a trade. I used to go to the butcher shop too and help out the butcher, saw bones and pack meat and all like that. He wanted to be a butcher boy or butcher, and I wanted no part of that at all. No, I wanted baseball.
You wanted baseball.
Yeah.
So you just kind of And so your dad finally said okay.
Well, yeah. Finally, they said okay. And when I told them about the $350 a month, that made everything okay.
That,
you know,
that changed the story in a hurry.
So I went away with the Syracuse club, and I was with them about 2 months.
Okay. Did you know Clara at that time?
No. I got to meet Clara in 1930.
Yeah, comes later.
When I came to Cincinnati.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went up to Syracuse in the International
Well,
League.
Yeah. Well, I made a road trip. I made a road trip with them. They went from there to Baltimore. Baltimore was in the International League at the time. Baltimore, Rochester was another team before we got back into Syracuse. So I stayed there about, I'd say about a month and a half, just maybe 2 months, when they finally found me out to Lawrence, Massachusetts of the New England League. It was a Class B league. It was more of a... More twilight ball, because they had a lot of woolen mills up there, and they used to get out about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'd come to see the ball game before going home to eat. And, I loved it up there. And I found it nice. Finished out the year pretty good. And I belonged to the Cardinals
now,
at the time.
You were playing third base at the time.
Well, no, then they moved me to second base.
Second base.
At that time, yeah. And then the Cardinals...
They bought your contract.
They took my contract and brought it back, and then the next year, that was in 26... at Lawrence, but now they wanted me to go to Topeka, Kansas.
That's a good place.
Well, you know, I never knew where Topeka was. And I wrote Branch Rickey a letter and asked him if he would option me again to Lawrence, Massachusetts in that New England League, because I liked it so well up there. And sure enough, he did. He sent me up there back again.
What did you like about this little mill town? Tell me something about, as minor league players in those days, where did you stay?
Well, they had hotels. When I got there, they said go to a certain hotel that housed all the ball players. I think they cost me $4 a week to live at this hotel.
Okay.
And of course, occasionally on a Saturday or Sunday, they even give you a meal a dinner mm-hmm. for the $4 or $5. Mm-hmm. It was real.
So, you just ate out all the time, or just
The 2 years I went in Lawrence, I stayed at that one place, same place, and I didn't know too many of the boys up there. They're mostly young kids, just like myself, 16, mm-hmm. 17, 18 years of age. There was two boys from New York that I got to know a little bit. One fellow was from Staten Island, the other boy from New Jersey, New Jersey.
I mean, being that young and out on the road, did you get kind of homesick?
Because I like baseball so much that I didn't even think about it.
I know, but you had a lot of spare time. What'd you do, Tony?
Well, we didn't have too much spare time. We'd go out to the ballpark about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. See, the game was at 4, but you get out there at 1 o'clock, and by the time you had your breakfast and all, you're about ready to go to the ballpark. Sometimes some people would pick you up and take you out to the ballpark. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'd have to get a trolley car. They used trolley cars and then were buses. Yeah. And once in a while, we had a bus. Mm-hmm. Because the bus cost more than the trolley.
Yeah. So you get out about 1 o'clock.
Have pepper games and toss the ball around until we have infield practice. Mm-hmm. And say the game would start at 4 o'clock. Usually we're through about 6 o'clock. And it was still light.
Okay. Showered up.
We were back at the hotel or our place where we slept by 7:30, 8 o'clock.
So you had the whole night, so you go movies, play cards?
No, we played little cards, but we didn't have no money to play cards, so it wasn't worthwhile playing.
Okay. Maybe the movies or something?
Oh, yeah.
Taking
a movie. Well, no, beer. I didn't think about beer at that time, of course. I think it was prohibition at that time. I think you couldn't buy beer.
Well, not across the counter. That's true.
Yeah.
And so you did that, and you went by train or bus from one town to another.
No, up in the New England League, the owner had three cars. That we had, I think, 16 players, and we'd fill in these three cars, and that's how we traveled.
What kind of cars were they?
One I rode in was a locomobile.
A who?
A locomobile. It was a big car that held 9 or 10 players, but we used to be maybe 6 at the most in the car, see? And the only trip that we had was real bad, was going up to Portland, Maine from Lawrence, Massachusetts, which was approximately about 200 miles, 250 mm-hmm. miles. But we went up there, we'd play Lewiston and Auburn, and then Portland. And we used to stay at Old Orchard Beach up there. It was a beautiful place, mm-hmm. right on the Atlantic Ocean. Mm-hmm. And then game time. Well, pretty all the games up there started at 4 o'clock. Why? I don't know. I know Haverhill was a mill town.
For the fans to get out of work.
Yes, that was probably. Mostly all woolen mills up in that area. Lowell, Massachusetts, Lawrence, Haverhill, Manchester, New Hampshire. And they all started at 4 o'clock, and mm-hmm. then I liked it better. It was not better. It was a little cooler in the afternoons like mm-hmm. that, and I enjoyed it.
Okay. Ballparks, what kind of
We had conditions? The one in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the shortest part of the field was center field. Mm-hmm. Center field was the shortest part of the field because right behind center field was the Merrimack River. and if you hit a ball real good, well, I'd say maybe about 325 feet.
Just dead away center?
Dead away center. Right field and left field were about 350, 355. But I guess there was no room in the back. You couldn't extend the fences anymore, no.
So they just had old wooden fences with a lot of advertisements
on? A lot of wooden fences. No, there were no advertisements. Just plain wood fence and all that. Every once in a while, the outfielders were running and knock a board down. So, and they'd have to nail it up again.
Did you see that? Happened in some minor league team, they had it on ESPN. Some outfielder was chasing the ball, and he went right through the fence.
No, I didn't see it, but that would happen up there, yeah. Uh-huh.
Went right through the fence.
Huh? Was he hurt?
Apparently not.
No.
He didn't hit that upper brace.
Yeah, there was one above and one below, and then you'd hit in the middle. You could break him right in the middle the board. We had fellas go through the fence like that, uh-huh. chasing the fly with their body, the weight of the body, and they break right through, and finally they'd have to patch it up before you could start the game again.
So that's pretty routine in the 1920s.
Oh, gee. And, real guy. I enjoyed it up there.
Who were some of the ball players that went up to the major leagues with you and out of that league that you remember?
Yes, Shanny Hogan was one up there. Clyde Sukforth.
He went up with the Dodgers, didn't he?
Sukforth went to Cincinnati. Shanny Hogan went to the Giants. Well, he was originally with the Braves, and then I think he made a deal for him. He went to the Giants after that. Mm-hmm. The fellow by the name of Simmons had a little shot with the Red Sox, a pitcher. Mm-hmm. Right offhand, a boy by the name of Con Cannon went to the Phillies. I had two boys in our club, Fritz Noethe and his brother, George Noethe. They were with the Phillies as infielders. They lasted maybe about 1 or 2 years, and they were out. I don't remember too many of them, but about 5 or 6 of them went up to the big leagues about the same time I did, see. But from there, they went to, from the Class B league, they went to an A league, and then a Double A, and then to the big leagues.
In those days, you really didn't have hitting and pitching coaches. You had a manager?
No, we just had a manager. That was all. One of the players coached third base.
How'd you learn some of the better points about fielding and hitting? Was it just natural ability, or was there any...
No one told me. I didn't get to know anything about fielding or hitting until I went to Columbus, Ohio, which was 1928. We had one coach, an old-time infielder, yeah.
And in those days, that was Double-A ball.
It was Double-A ball at that time.
And that was owned by the Cincinnati
club? Yeah, Cincinnati owned. But later on, the Cardinals took over, yeah.
So you moved up pretty quickly from Class D, the New England
Class
league.
B, the next year, my third year, they sent me to Danville, Illinois in a 3I league.
Okay.
That's where that was owned by the Cardinals also. And Jimmy Jordan was with me, Rip Collins, Joe Schultz. There was two of them. The young kid was just coming up at the time. The old man was a Cardinal player. He was our manager.
Who's that?
Joe Schultz, the original Joe Schultz. And then he had Joe Jr. Uh-huh. He was just about getting ready to play ball. So he was about 16, 17 at the time.
So you were about 18, 19 years old at
the
time. I
was about 19 at night when I went to Columbus, about 28. I went from Danville to Indianapolis to meet the Columbus Ball Club there, and I've had 3 weeks of the 28 season, and the season was over. And then 1929, I got a contract from Columbus again to go to spring training in Lakeland, Florida. That was, for me, that was quite a thrill.
That was.
Yeah.
So you were still making $350 a month, or did they give you a raise?
Then I think my salary then was about $450 a month.
That's
that
good
was Double A. Well, yeah. But I thought, no, some of the boys coming back, of course, a lot of the boys came back from the big leagues, and they were making $1,000 a month. Money was really real good at that time.
That's right, before the Depression.
Yeah. Nick Niebergall, who was with the fellow brought me over there, he was making $1,000 a month. Another pitcher, I think his name was Dickerson. He was making $1,000. He'd come up from the Cardinals down.
You're only paying $5-6 a week for
room,
a hotel room.
Yeah.
I guess you sent all your money back home?
Yes. In fact, I didn't know anything about how to send money home, whether to make it a check or not. So I used to get a shoebox and put the money in a shoebox.
In cash?
And mail it home. And they kept a bank account for me.
Oh,
yeah.
No, I guess it all arrived safely, all that cash.
I didn't know anything about...
Checking account.
I just kept enough cash to pay my bills and my room and food and all like that.
I'm being facetious, so there was no guy said, hey, let me be your agent, Tony, and I'll show you how to manage your money.
I don't know. I think some of the boys that were with me, they did the same thing. That's how I got to know how to send my money home.
Find a shoebox.
Yeah, find a shoebox and send the money home.
So it was in Columbus that you really got some of the finer points of hitting and
pitching. We had a coach, I can't think of his name right now. He used to be with the Phillies and the Giants. He played about 10 years in the major leagues, and he knew a lot more than what we knew, and he would help us fielding and batting, how to play hitters, watch the pitcher, find out from the pitcher how they're going to pitch certain hitters, and you can move around because... If you pitch a fellow outside, a right-hand hitter outside, he'd most likely hit the ball to right field a little bit. Mm-hmm. Pitch him inside, they'd get around, and then you would move on the infield. You'd move right or left a little bit as you knew where they were going to pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it a lot easier for me. I tell you why. No. I wasn't very fast. And that was one of the reasons why the Cardinals sold me to Cincinnati, because I couldn't run. At that time, Branch Rickey, he was for speed. All he wanted, number one, was speed.
Well, of course, they had that Gas House Gang,
yes,
and Pepper Morgan, and Leo DeRocher.
Every one of them could run.
Yeah.
He got rid of, that one year, 1928, he got rid of 8 players from our own ball club, the Danville Ball Club. The only one he kept was Rip Collins for about 2 or 3 years. And Rip wasn't a speed demon, but he did have power. He could hit home runs. But then he traded him off too. All he wanted was speed.
Mm-hmm. In those days, now this is when you were playing second base and third base, Tony?
No, mostly second base at that time, yes.
So you knew what kind of pitch of course, by reading the catcher sign.
Yes.
How'd you signal the outfielders to shift around without
making
it conspicuous?
Well, we never did then. No, never did. Never did? Not until we got to the big leagues.
You didn't put a signal behind your back or a glove?
Hand behind your back, yes. You close a fist, make a fist, or open palm, meaning curveball, fastball, and they would judge for themselves who was hitting.
Okay, but of course they had, the outfielders couldn't shift immediately when they saw the signal because that would tip off the batter.
Well, yeah, but what they'd usually do is try to pick up something on the ground, walk over 5 or 6 feet and pick something on the ground, make out they're putting it in their pocket, stay there. Don't go back to the original place that they were.
A little finesse there. Always picking up
cigarette
butts or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Something that just all of a sudden comes out of my mind.
Well, see, you don't, until you get to the big leagues where they had 2 and 3 coaches, where you got a little more experience from the players that you played with. They helped you, and then we had coaches that would take you aside.
So you were really on your own in the...
Up until I got to the Columbus, I was up to my own, but then I didn't have a little help then, but not much, just a little bit. Because one man used to take care of 22 players, which was kind of tough. See, when you got in the big leagues, you'd have one man take care of you, come out and show you how to hit, and or what you're doing wrong and hitting and all of that. Like when I went to Cincinnati, Harry Heilman, the old Detroit ball player, he was with us that one year, and I got into a little rut, and I asked Harry if he would come out early tomorrow morning to help me hitting a little bit. And he said, I'll be out there at 10 o'clock, you be there. And sure enough, he helped me, and I finished the year hitting .315 at Cincinnati, 1930. And I was, in fact, they took me out of the lineup on account of I wasn't hitting at the time.
So you were sold to the Cincinnati club. Branch Rickey sold you.
That was 1929. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 28 and 9, and then I went to Columbus.
They were
owned by the Cincinnati at that time. And about a year or two later, the St. Louis club took the club over.
So you came up in 1930 with the
Cincinnati
Redstockings, Red Legs.
Red Legs is what they called,
In that old ballpark, later became known as Crosley Field.
Crosley Field, yeah.
Okay.
I think they called it Redland.
Something like that, Crosley bought the club back in, I think, the mid-30s from a bank or something, and he was making cars and refrigerators and owned a big radio station, station.
He did, yes.
That he later brought up Red Barber from Gainesville, Florida, to broadcast ball games.
Yes, well, he came up. I had left the ball club when he brought Red
you
up.
Yeah, were over the Dodgers by that time. Your first year.
My God, he came in, Sidney Wild was there for 1 year or 2 years, I think. He owned a club. Then he sold it to Crosley. Mm-hmm. And Crosley was making that little car at that time.
Yeah.
And I tried to buy a little car from him. I thought maybe I'd get a break in price. He said, no, you'll pay as much as the other people.
No discounts.
I didn't buy no Crosley.
Okay, no discounts.
No.
Your first year in the majors, 1930, the golden age of sports, not only baseball, but boxing and track and field, tennis. We could talk about a number of legends. As a rookie, was there some little initiation rites that you had to pay before you were accepted as a major leaguer by some of the veterans? Like, we'll give Tony a size 45 jacket, and we'll give him a size 45 waist, and he can do with that, and if he can wear them, fine. If not, that's his tough luck.
Well, I tell you what, when I first went to Cincinnati, we trained at... We trained right here at Tampa, Florida, that 1 year, well, 2 years, in fact. I tried to, in spring training, in fact, we used to split the squad up. We had maybe 35, 40 players, and so you can get a little hitting practice. Mm-hmm. And I tried to go in and hit, and the old-timers wouldn't let me go in and hit. It wasn't until Harry Heilman took charge of me, and he said, let that kid get in there and hit. That's the only way I got to hit. Otherwise, I'd go 2 or 3 days without hitting batting practice.
They just wouldn't let you in.
No, they wouldn't let me in to hit. No, the old timers.
They thought you were taking their job.
I guess so. Which I did. I'll never forget that. Joe Stripp was a third baseman at the club, and Harry Reconda was a third baseman. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Huey Kreitz was a second baseman. He was a star at that one, and I couldn't play second base on account of he there. So they said, work out at third base. Opening day, my God, I played third base.
Opening day.
We had Charlie Dressen was with us, too. I remember Dan Howley asking Charlie Dressen to move me. We were playing the Pittsburgh Pirates with the Wayner brothers over there. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want you to move that kid right, left, back, forth, inside, outside, and all like that. And I had to look in, and he would move me, whoever was hitting at the net. And then not until June of that year when they traded Huey Kreitz to New York, New York Giants, and they moved me to second base, put Stripp back at first base, at third base, and put George Kelly, big George Kelly, at first base. Mm-hmm. And then I played the rest of the year at second base.
Did you have a favorite, second or third base?
Yes, yeah.
Which was your favorite?
I enjoyed second base, but I played more second base. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we had, I'll tell you who came over from the ball club from the Yankees, Leo DeRocher. Leo was quite a hell of a fielder. My God, he could field the ball good.
At shortstop.
And he took Horace Ford's place. Mm-hmm. He used to be Ford and Kreitz was the double play combination. Mm-hmm. In fact, they held a record making double plays. So 1931, the whole team broke a record. The team broke the record. DeRocher broke a record. I broke a record. The first baseman broke a record. Double plays. I think we made 205 double plays. The most, the record at that time about 160 or 70 at the time. And my record stood until Jackie Robinson at Brooklyn broke it, which was about 16, 17 years later.
Mm-hmm. Or double play combinations.
Double play.
What made that, you say you weren't a speed demon. So you had to really use the judgment of how to play each batter.
Yes.
And, making a double play is no easy task.
Well, what I did,
because you have to have that synchronization.
Well, I got to talk to the pitchers a lot and ask them how they would pitch certain hitters, inside, outside. If they pitch them inside, I'd just gradually move over a little bit to my right. If they're going to pitch away from them, I'd go a little bit to my left. Mm-hmm. Or they most likely would hit the balls away. Not until I went to Brooklyn with Lopez being a catcher, He used to move me before giving a sign to the pitcher. Mm-hmm. He'd right hand, he'd move me, which I could move toward the right field side. Left hand, he'd move me back toward the other side, which was a big help.
How'd you disguise that? I mean, you couldn't do it in the batter watching shifting around.
Maybe you go over and pick up a matchstick instead of going back.
So you picked up the old matchstick still.
Because I always can remember Casey Stengel when Casey came up to, Casey managed Brooklyn after Max Carey. He said, how come, he said, you were in front of a lot of line drives, and then when Jimmy Jordan used to relieve me, he said he'd have to run like hell to get in front of a ball. I didn't tell him that I was getting signs from Lopez moving right and left. Uh-huh. That made it a lot easier for me on account of my feet and my speed, see. Uh-huh.
And the double play, now tell me, I want you to tell the truth.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Let me ask this question about the double play. I want you to tell me the truth. Of all of the double plays that you made, how many times do you really think you hit second base or you missed it by maybe a shade and kicked up some dirt and the umpire says, okay.
Yes, I tell you what, a lot of times your feet were near the bag and you just take and throw the ball and you wouldn't even feel the bag. Now, I'd be honest with you, I couldn't tell you whether I touched the bag or not, and the umpire would always call them out.
Yeah.
Unless you stepped right on top of the bag and then made you be a pivot and
That's
made
right.
the play.
There, there's, but if you're... If you're coming across, Leo was throwing it to you, and you'd throw up a little bit of dirt.
Because I never forget Leo, when we first, 1931, when we set this record, he came over to me and said, how do you like the ball at second base on double plays? I said, well, I used to like to make the play on the inside of the bag, which is the left side of the bag. Mm-hmm. I used to pivot and wheel on the inside. He said, I said about shoulder high, real shoulder high on the inside of it. My God, that's where all his... Well, he'd make all the throws, that's where it'd be.
That's
and made it a lot easier for me to make the double play. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, of course, the ball would get away from him and it'd be low or to the right and all like that.
Yeah.
But, we set that record. The whole team did. The first baseman did. He did. I did. Yeah. And I think 210 or somewhere around, 205 or 10. And it stayed for, 15, 20 years, somewhere like that.
Yeah.
before Jackie Robinson broke mine. Mm-hmm. He came up later. He came up 46 or 7, 48, somewhere around there, mm-hmm. yeah.
So you started out in a spectacular way. And why were you traded then to the Dodgers? I mean, your first year, my record is that as a rookie third baseman, you batted 312. You hit 304 more times. And why after, with that kind of big splash, that you got traded to the Dodgers?
Well, one of the big reasons, I held out the second year. I hit, I think, 312 and 315 mm-hmm. for 30 and 31. And Sidney Weiler, who was the owner at the time, wouldn't give me a raise. So Strip and I, we got together.
Well, what'd you make, about $5,500 your first year as a rookie?
$5,500. It was about $1,000 a month is what it was. Mm-hmm. We played about five and a half mm-hmm. Months at that time. That's what we get paid mm-hmm. for the months you play.
Yeah.
So I held out. I was here in spring training. I was
down.
In Florida mm-hmm. waiting to see what was going to happen. And sure enough, the Cincinnati Club trained here in Tampa, and the Brooklyn Club trained at Clearwater. Mm-hmm. And I figured, well, I don't know where I was going to go. Sure enough, I got a call and said, you're traded to Brooklyn. So Joe Stripp, Clyde Sukforth, and myself went to Brooklyn for Ernie Lombardi, Babe Herman, and Wally Gilbert.
That's what Cincinnati got.
Yeah, they...
Boy, I tell you, you're in good company.
Well, I tell you, they won a pennant, 39 and 40, I believe.
39 and 40, yeah, they won the World Series. World Series, in 30,
yeah.
Or,
they played the Yankees one year,
right,
I believe,
uh-huh.
yeah.
They played the Yankees.
I think the Yankees
think
beat them one.
Yeah, they beat them, and then I think Cincinnati beat the Tigers in 39, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So, off to Brooklyn, back home.
Yes. I tell
Evansville.
You what, I got a raise. I don't exactly remember what it was, but I know it got a little raise, mm-hmm. and it saved money anyway by living home. And I didn't, of course, the hotels were a little more expensive mm-hmm. in 1930. Most of the players stayed at the St. George in Brooklyn, which I don't know exactly how much they paid, but I know it had to be maybe $6 or $7 per day, which wasn't too much, but. When you're not making too much money,
you can stay home. And
we had home stands for 20 and 22 days at a time. Then we'd hit the road. Yeah, 20, 22 days.
They were that long?
Yes. You play the whole Western swing come in, and also then the Eastern clubs before you hit the road for 22 days. That's how long a road trip you'd have.
Well, I had forgotten about that. Just
remember, four-game series, and then you'd play the Eastern clubs also before coming back
That's
home.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course,
four threes
seven,
of 12
with seven other teams in the
yeah.
league, and so
there was eight clubs at the
yeah, eight all together.
So you had played seven teams so, yeah.
In that homestand.
Yeah.
And so is this where you met Clara?
1930. Her sister was living in Cincinnati, working in Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and. So she came over to visit. I got to know her very good. I got invited to the house for spaghetti. Mm-hmm. You know that. So she said that her sister...
Going to fill you up a little Italian body with pasta, huh?
Yeah. And a good old wine. And
uh-huh.
and so she invited her over.
You lost all your resistance.
I think it helped me. It made me a little stronger. So she came over from Cincinnati, from Indianapolis that one time. And I don't know, some affair. Wasn't it something like that?
I was in a wedding.
It was a wedding or something like that, yeah.
Bridesmaid, my cousin's
mm-hmm.
wedding.
Mm-hmm. And
so that's started I got to meet her a little bit. Well, it was hard to date. She was in Indianapolis, living in Indianapolis at the time. And then I was in Cincinnati. But
that's
then
right.
A year later, she came to Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. He begged me.
He begged you?
Yeah.
And you said yes?
Well,
yes.
She claims I begged her, but I think she wanted to come there.
Okay. What'd your father or mother think about dating a ball player?
I asked her. She said, "You make your bed and you lie in it." I was going steady with another gentleman in Indianapolis,
uh-huh.
and he took me away from him. So I had to.
Tony
get my,
did.
Yeah, he had. I had to ask my mother which way to go.
Uh-huh. And she wouldn't tell you.
No.
She blames me. She left him to come to me. Now she's blaming me.
One of those things. It happened.
It happened.
Yes, it happened.
Uh-huh.
And I don't regret it.
That's right. And 50 years later, you just celebrated your...
59 this year.
Oh, 59 years.
We got married in the fall of 1932.
Those pictures up there are the 50th. My son gave us a big splash.
So And that's your son and daughter?
Two boys and a girl, yeah.
Uh-huh. For your 59th?
No, that was the 50th.
That was the 50th.
50th, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, in October would be, ooh.
So, a grand event. You were selected to the All-Star team your first year with
1933, yes.
Brooklyn. Share some memories of Comiskey Park, 1933.
Well, see, that was in the American League. I never knew Comiskey Park at that time.
Okay.
See,
that's where the first game was played.
Was in the, and I can remember very, very well in that game, John McGraw called me in about the sixth or seventh inning. I think Bartell started the game at shortstop. Either Bartell or Woody English started, and he was going to take him out, so he wanted me to hit for either one of those two, whoever started the game. Mm-hmm. But then he realized that I didn't play short. If he used me, then he'd have to use the other player to mm-hmm. play short, so he'd use two men at that one for that one time. So he said, wait a while. So he let either English hit. I think Bartell started the game. So mm-hmm. English hit and went to play short. So then in the ninth inning, he called me over again, and he said, get your bat, you're going to hit for Hubble. Hubble, I think, was the third hitter. Mm-hmm. So there's two out, and he called me. He said, go up there. We were two runs behind. The score was 4-2 at the time. Mm-hmm. He said, I want you to take a strike. And I got to thinking to myself, I got to take a strike against Robert Grove. They called him Moses Grove.
Why would he?
The way he threw, I said, he ought to give me a strike. But I tell you what, though, I scared him a little bit. I hit one ball real good. The second pitch, I took the one. The third pitch was the first one was inside. The second was a strike. And then the third pitch that he made, I hit a ball in the left field stands about, I'd say, maybe 4 or 5 feet foul. Uh-huh. Had it been a little more to the right, it would have been a home run in Comiskey Park, which was quite a big ballpark at that time.
That's right.
Uh-huh. I think left field down there was about 359 feet. Uh-huh. But then I fouled off a pitch, and the next one he threw right down the middle, and I swung, and boy, it wasn't there.
It wasn't there.
The end of the ball game.
End of the game.
Yeah.
You have some other memories of, you know, here the first All-Star game. Did you think of it as a history-making event?
Yes, I enjoyed it. You know, at that time, being the first All-Star game, the National League Club made uniforms for us.
Special uniforms?
Special uniforms. And it was National League across the uniform, and they gave them to us to keep.
Oh.
Which I thought was real nice. And the other club, the American
still
League
have
Club.
That, Tony?
Yes. No, I had it up until a few years ago. It disappeared.
Oh,
yeah. The painters mm-hmm. went off with it.
Yeah,
I didn't even know it was gone, because some fellow asked me, he said, you got your National League uniform? Mm-hmm. I know a man will give you $3,000 for the uniform. I said, $3,000? That was a lot of money for a uniform. And I went to look for it, and I couldn't find it. Couldn't find it.
So they had special uniforms. I guess they also had special
ones
for the
American League. Across the top,
did they have special ones for the American League?
No, American League used their own. The players used their own home uniforms. Yeah,
and you were the traveling.
They were
team.
The home club at the time.
That's
see,
right.
So they used white.
And the fans voted Tony Cuccinello to be the.
That time it wasn't the fans. I think he was selected by either the manager of the club or some officials. Later on, it came where the fans voted for.
So John McGraw said, I want Tony Cuccinello
on
the team.
They made sure that every club was represented.
That's
see?
Right, at least had one member.
And then that's how I was the only one from the Brooklyn club.
You were the only one?
Yeah.
That help on pay raise?
Well, I know. At that particular time, it was in July, I think, the All-Star game.
Uh-huh.
And I was going along pretty good. And, and that's the reason they selected me, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And John McGraw was the manager for the National League. Connie Mack was the manager
for the American League.
Because they had won the pennant there.
And the coaches were like Bill McKechnie, one of the managers. We had two managers. I can't think of the second one. I know Bill McKechnie was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, the manager of my club, the Brooklyn club, Max Carey. He was a coach in the club.
Fantastic base stealer?
Yes. Yeah, he was my manager in 33.
Uh-huh.
Then 34, Casey came in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So with all the pomp and lots of, you know, first time, you...
Well, to me, it was quite a thrill, even just to be there, to look in the stands. It must have been 50,000 people in there.
You know, you had Lou Gehrig, you had Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
I don't know the starting lineup.
Frankie Frisch, our club, Bill Terry,
that's right.
Bill Hallahan,
uh-huh.
Carl Hubble.
Hack Wilson?
Hack Wilson. He was there, too, yeah. Oh, let's see. I can't even think of the catcher. Gabby, no, not Gabby.
Hartman.
Gabby Hartman, I believe, was the catcher, yes. Yeah, that's what. Paul Wainer. To me, they were all my idols.
Yes.
They were great.
And here you are, one of the gang.
Yeah, I was one of the...
did you get together before the game and talk strategy? Or
yes, they did a little bit.
Of...
Well, McGraw had a little meeting and
what
talked
say?
About... Well, he talked about, there's no use us going over the hitters, he said, but we... If you look in, he said, if I think I know some of these fellows and I'm going to move you around, he said, look in. He had a scorecard like Connie Mack did, and he'd move the outfielders all back, right, left a little bit. Well, there wasn't much to do because they were all stars and all great hitters, every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was probably the lowest batting average. I was just about maybe 300. Mm-hmm. All the rest were 340, 350, mm-hmm. some close to 400. Mm-hmm.
Of course, at that time, Hack Wilson, that's when he set that major league record that still stands for RBIs,
181. Yeah,
190.
Yes.
That still stands today.
Yes, it's still a record, yeah.
He was a short man, only about 5'6".
He was shorter than I was. I'm 5'7 and a half. He was about 5'6".
But he had an 18-inch neck, about a size 5 shoe.
Real short.
The barrel, I mean, just a...
Well, then, you know, later on, he came to Brooklyn. We had him in Brooklyn for a year.
He had a very painful and tragic life.
Yes, I know he did.
Couldn't leave the bottle alone.
When he died, we all chipped in to bury him. Mm-hmm. All the players in the whole league chipped in at $10 or $15 each to bury him.
This is side two of tape number one, conversation with Tony Cuccinello, and we were just finishing about the 1933 All-Star game. And you were going to say something, Tony.
Well, I mean, before the game, McGraw talked to the players. You know, he said,
right.
No use us going over the hitters. They're all stars, like you fellas.
Okay.
So,
was there a lot of all-star games in other sports, like basketball, like football, they just go through the formality. But the baseball all-star game, there was that intense, we're going to win.
Yes, they all wanted to win. I mean, they was... It was something good for the league, National League.
Yeah, uphold that league.
Of course, I do know the president of the league came in and talked to us before, and he said, fellas, this means a lot to the National League. Go out and win this ball game. Win it for me. See?
Newt Rockne,
I think it was John Heidler was the president of the league at that time.
American League won. I guess it was a few years later, in the late 30s, before the National League won the All-Star
game. See, at that time, the American...